Hello, my name is Chip Lang. You're listening to Total EM. Today we have a podcast that is going to feel a little different than usual. That's because I'm not going to really be talking in it at all. In fact, Melody Kolmitz, who is going to be our guest today, when we initially recorded this together, it's a long story, but basically we lost the audio in such a way that it was irreparable and there was nothing I could do about it. And so Melody was kind enough to re-record her end, and she did it in such a way that was pretty nice. It really doesn't need my input in there. I am going to also give a little bit at the end that'll just kind of tie things in, but that's about it. You're not really going to hear from me on this one. It is just going to be Melody, so please listen in. This is still very helpful. This is still a conversation we need to have about end-of-life care discussions.
Good morning. My name is Melody Kolmitz. Thank you for inviting me to share some time with you on the Total EM podcast. I'm a physician assistant and have been for the past 22 years. I currently serve as a principal faculty member in the Rochester Institute of Technology Physician Assistant Program. My background as a PA is somewhat varied, and I believe that I have a unique perspective because I continue to function in the field as a pre-hospital care provider. I've been a paramedic for the last 6 years, and prior to that, I was an EMT. My background as a PA includes a long stint in primary care with a bunch of moonlighting in EM and on hospitalist service. Most recently, I transitioned to a specialty care practice working on an inpatient GI consult service and also working in outpatient specialty GI care. I really feel like this broad range of experiences, both inpatient and outpatient, primary care, specialty care, and pre-hospital care, give me a somewhat unique perspective. I think you could probably blame it on the fact that I get bored rather easily, so I need to keep myself challenged. Today we're going to talk a bit about end-of-life discussions. This is a subject that is very near and dear to my heart for a couple of personal reasons. One of the reasons that my career took such a broad range is that about 10 years ago, both of my parents became acutely ill at the same time. My dad had two pretty significant CVAs requiring long stints in rehab about 6 months after his second rehab visit. My mom was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. I'm very thankful to my career as a PA, which allowed me to change gears and continue with my per diem work while I took care of my kids and took care of my parents. I was able to provide in-home hospice care for my mom until she passed away. And I always say that this was my mom's final gift to me. If I could have this sort of end-of-life discussion with her, then that means I can have it with anybody. And it truly is something that takes practice. I would never have hoped to have that practice come from personal experience with my own family members, but that's how it worked out. About 6 months ago, my father became acutely ill with sepsis related to some long-term vascular dermatologic issues that he'd been dealing with. And I had a completely different experience with his end-of-life process. So I hope to share a little bit about that with you today. I think the first discussion point is, why is this so difficult for clinicians to discuss with patients? I think that it's difficult for a variety of reasons. One of those reasons being time. We don't have a lot of time to sit and discuss these worldly issues with our patients and their family members. I know that I feel like I'm always crunched for time, and I feel like I spend half my time typing information into the computer rather than actually talking to the patients. And that's a source of great frustration for me, and I suspect it is for other care providers. The second issue that makes it difficult is if you haven't had to do this and you haven't had that practice, it's very, very daunting. How do you bring up this subject if you're the patient's primary care physician or physician assistant? And even greater, how do you bring this topic up when you're the person caring for that patient in the emergency room or in the specialist's office? You don't have a long-term relationship with the patient and the family. So I think that makes it an even more daunting task. I did some research and found some fairly good information, recent information actually, to find some tools that may make this a little bit easier for us to evaluate as care providers in our own mind and to discuss the topic with patients and family members. One of the things I found was a good article from the Journal of Oncologic Practice from June, actually. It is an article that focuses on good communication and better end-of-life outcomes. They advocate using a tool called a patient values assessment, which is a simple 10-question tool that allows the clinician to really figure out what's important to that patient. Example being, I don't want to be a burden to my family. I don't want to have a lot of cost associated with my end of life, etc. And the conclusion with this article is that this values assessment is feasible and scalable. It gives us a tangible, objective measure in order to rank and determine what's important to the patient. And the other thing that they found is that this values assessment facilitates advanced care planning discussions. The thought is that this can actually lead to less aggressive care at the end of life. This is a good time for me to share my experience with my mom and compare and contrast that with the experience I had with my dad. My mom had always been very vocal about what her end-of-life wishes were. She didn't want to suffer, didn't want to have pain, didn't want to be a burden on her friends and family. She always said to me, "You'll know when the time comes, and I look to you to tell me that that time is near." When her cancer became very advanced and she was very symptomatic from it, she developed an obstructive pneumonia, as is so typical of lung cancer patients, and I knew that it was time to have that discussion. So we spent about an hour talking about what her choices were, i.e. go to the hospital, get antibiotics, potentially beat this pneumonia, versus saying, this is the end, and I'm going to make an active choice not to take treatment. My mom reached out, took both of my hands in hers, and said, "I always told you that you would know when it was time. And it's time. I'm tired. So I don't want to go to the hospital. I want to stay home. Call in the troops. Do what you need to do. Call the hospice folks. Let's make this happen." And I'm so grateful to her for knowing what her wishes were and for making them known. It wasn't difficult for me as a daughter or as a care provider to make that transition in my mind because we had had that discussion so many times in the past. With my dad, the situation was significantly different. He had been hospitalized multiple times for sepsis of a variety of origins. And each time when he went to the hospital, I was there at the bedside when he was admitted and when that discussion was had. He was reasonable and always signed a MOLST form and said, "I don't want CPR, I don't want intubation, I don't want artificial nutrition, etc." On his last hospitalization, he went to our local community hospital because he, quote unquote, wasn't feeling well. He was bradycardic hypotensive, etc. and ended up being transferred to a different larger tertiary medical center because that's where they had bed availability. I was not present when that transfer took place. I was contacted by telephone and obviously proceeded there as quickly as I could get there. When I arrived, one of the questions I obviously asked was, do you have a copy of his advanced directives? And I was told very adamantly that he was adamant that he wanted everything done, so he was a full code. This was a shock to me because it was contrary to any experience and any discussion we'd ever had in the past. This played out as a continued source of great frustration because he decompensated multiple times during the hospitalization. I, as the family member, revisited the discussion multiple times, and I can assure you that the care providers on both the medical floor and in the intensive care unit never broached the subject with me at all, and that was hugely frustrating. When the time came and it was obvious that he was not going to recover from this acute illness, I received the phone call, the one that we all dread making, and certainly I dreaded receiving. But on the other hand, I was grateful that someone finally reached out and actually had this discussion with me. I sat with the intensivist from the ICU and we had a long chat about this before I made the decision to withdraw care. One of the main concerns that I had as a family member was the fact that he had been adamant that he wanted everything done, which was so contrary to previous experiences. And she said to me, "Melody, you know what happened." And I said, "I know that I know what happened, but I need to hear it from you to be at peace in my own mind." And she said, "Well, when he came in, he was septic, clearly wasn't perfusing his brain. I don't really think he had a good understanding of the decision that he made, number one. And number two, that person that admitted him from the emergency room was simply checking a box. I can guarantee to you that there was no long discussion. There wasn't even a brief discussion. It was, do you want everything done or do you have advanced directives? Check. So you shouldn't feel badly about having to make this decision because in all honesty, he probably shouldn't have been a full code in the first place." I'll tell you, as a care provider, a clinician, and a family member, that gave me great peace. But it also upset me. If that was my experience as a healthcare provider, I can only imagine the type of experiences that non-healthcare savvy folks experience. So that being said, what sort of other tools are out there that can help us start these discussions with family members and with patients? One of the helpful tools that I found is something called conversation starters. This is some research done by the John A. Hartford Foundation. And these conversation starters are really helpful and very, very interesting. One of the most interesting pieces of information from this conversation starter website that I found was some research and insight from clinicians and patients on these conversations about end-of-life care and what their wishes are. Key points from this particular piece of research include: clinicians are able to sort out two types of advanced care planning conversations. First of all, the early kind that occurs with relatively healthy patients, and second, the later discussions that come after a serious illness or diagnosis. That helps differentiate between the experience I had with my mom and the experience with my dad is that my mom had cancer. It was clearly a terminal illness. My dad, however, had end-stage congestive heart failure, and he actually died of sepsis. CHF and sepsis are not conditions that we necessarily readily associate with terminal illness. So that raises the question, what really truly counts as a terminal illness? Should heart failure count? Should other end-stage diseases count as terminal illness? In my opinion, yes, we need to have these discussions earlier on, but we as clinicians need to define in our own mind that other things besides malignancy can truly be terminal illness. We certainly have encouraged patients to be more involved in end-of-life care, and I know that I've had this discussion with multiple patients through the years, and I know that I could certainly serve to improve how I go about having these discussions with patients. One of the things that I've worked on is to improve my discussion of what CPR actually means. And I know we've all done this. Do you want someone to compress your chest? Do you want someone to put a tube in your lungs if you're unable to breathe for yourself, etc.? But I think it's very important for patients to truly understand what CPR is, what the risks and benefits of CPR are, and what the likely complications and success rate are. There's an interesting article from Anesthesia Intensive Care from just this past May. It's a survey, an interview-administered survey conducted in a tertiary care facility in Singapore in 2015. But it measured patients' knowledge, attitudes, and preferences regarding CPR in a series of 18 questions. Now, granted, small sample size, 51 out of 67 patients completed the survey. Interestingly, 80.4% of participants correctly understood the purpose of CPR, but 64.7% did not know of any possible complications. Less than half the participants, 41.2%, had thought about life support measures they wanted for themselves. Most of the participants agreed that they should personally be involved in making end-of-life decisions, but they had a poor knowledge of CPR and other resuscitative measures. And the majority, here's the key, overestimated the success rate of CPR. So I think we as clinicians need to develop an honest, straightforward approach of discussing CPR with our patients. And it should be like any other process. We should really be discussing risk versus benefits. We should be discussing the likelihood of success and possible complications. And like any other procedure, we should probably be documenting the specifics of those discussions. That certainly would help the patients make better decisions, and it would help the care provider who potentially comes after you and is involved in that patient's care. So finally, where do we go from here? How do we make this process better? A couple of really good toolkits that I found during my research. One of them is called the Conversation Project. This Conversation Project provides a whole kit for families and for clinicians in multiple languages, which I thought was very, very helpful. So often we find these patient education materials printed only in English or in English and Spanish, but this gives us a variety of languages, which is so important. Culture matters. Different things are acceptable in different cultures, so that's important to consider as well. They even provide these materials in larger print, which is another important consideration, particularly for our elders with visual impairments. The second toolkit that I found is something from the AMA, and it's called Steps Forward. That you can actually obtain CME credit from using this module. They also provide a complete end-of-life letter toolkit. It's a toolkit for the patient to consider what their wishes are towards the end of life and to write a letter to their physician and potentially to their family members about what matters to them. This goes back to that values assessment that we talked about earlier. An example end-of-life template provided here. What matters to me? What are my important future life milestones? This is how we prefer to handle bad news in my family. This is how we make medical decisions in my family. These are the people that I want to make these medical decisions if I'm not able to. What I do not want at the end of my life. What I do want at the end of my life. If my pain and distress are out of control, this is how I wish for it to be addressed. I think this is a much more inclusive letter, and I think it would really be helpful for patients to be able to provide that information to their care provider and share it with their family. It can easily be personalized. And as a family member who recently went through this sort of traumatic experience, I know that it would have given me great peace of mind to actually have something like this from my father, which would have made the decision much, I won't say easier, but much more clear-cut for me as his daughter. The other important piece to remember is that primary care physicians and PAs are now able to bill for advanced care planning discussions. So don't forget that you can actually document the time spent and bill for these services. So I know that I felt in the past that this is a time-consuming sort of discussion, and I felt like I didn't have enough time and didn't have enough hours in the day to possibly do a good job in that 15-minute slot, time slot that I'd been given with the patient. But now knowing that I can actually bill for this service allows me to take more time with patients, take more time with family members, and really truly document and potentially use some of these tools to put in writing what the patient's wishes truly are.
All right, I'm going to cut in here real quick because Melody is about to sign off. Basically, as a recap, there are a lot of different aspects with this. I know this feels more like a primary care talk, and part of it is because it is. A lot of this is going to be primary care type in nature, but we still need to understand this to apply this in our own regards and to better serve our patients, because even if they are not there specifically for that end of life event at that time, we need to consider this and we need to make those options available. I've had patients I've run to in particular recently where there really isn't this setup there. And so we've talked about it, I've gone over it with families and stuff like that. And this, I didn't really realize this until recently, is something you can bill, and it appears to be something you can even bill in emergency medicine. There are CPT codes that are applicable to this. As best as I understand, I'm not billing agent or anything like that. I don't have the special skills to that, so I can't guarantee it. But basically, when you look through it, this should be something we should still be able to bill. There are some criteria to it. Please go to the show notes to see what exactly you need for this. But essentially, just remember that this is something we can do. And this is something that we need to do, even in emergency medicine. Like I said, plan to have more on this in the future still, but I really wanted to have this conversation, and this was something that Melody, thankfully, was able to still record, even though we had the issues from before. So thank you for sticking around and listening to it. All right, let's get this finished.
So thank you for spending some time with me today talking about end-of-life discussions. I certainly appreciate, both personally and professionally, what a difficult discussion this can be. I ask that you, as clinicians, really take on the responsibility of doing a good job with this, as hard as it may be. So until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.